The national average for a gallon of gas is up to $3.65. AAA says that's because of higher demand in the U.S. in the summer and unrest in Egypt. But for an increasing number of Americans, gas prices are not top of mind because we're not driving as much. A recent study from the advocacy group U.S. PIRG found that for the first time in six decades, Americans are actually driving less. In a little bit, we'll talk about what that means for cities and urban planning. But right now, we're going to be joined by veteran auto industry reporter Mickey Maynard, who is editing the upcoming ebook, Curbing Cars, Rethinking How We Get Around. Mickey, thanks for being here. And first off, why are people driving less?
Couple of reasons. One is the economy. So if you just look at the big macro statistics, people have only recovered about 40% of the wealth that was lost in the Great Recession. One of the things you can cut back on is using your car. You know, there are 60 cities all over the country where people are selling homes in suburbia, moving into new apartments and condos. When you get a new condo in the city, you usually have one parking space. So you don't need three cars anymore, and you couldn't park them anyway. And also, I haven't even mentioned public transportation, but there is record demand in this country and in Canada for the use of public transit.
And yet, many of the trains that we take, if we take trains around cities, have been around for a long time. There has not been a lot of upgrade to the systems that we've been using.
That's right. And if you look at the East Coast cities, if you look at Chicago, those systems were built 100 years ago. And so there hasn't been the upgrade. Some of the new subway systems, Atlanta, Miami, Los Angeles, those are newer systems. But even those systems are experiencing all this demand, and that puts strain on the system as well.
How much of this is a result of the young? People who are getting out of college cannot find work and therefore can't get a car. It's not their choice. They just can't do it. And then they end up needing public transit.
Right. So the average student who graduates from a four-year college has a debt load of $27,000. That's about what a new car costs. And, you know, there's kids that can't get a job either. And so if you don't have a job, you're probably not going to be buying a car. You'll probably be borrowing a car if your parents have one available for you.
Mickey, where is this shift happening? Is it just in cities or is it out in the countryside as well?
Well, first of all, it would be hard to live in North Dakota on a farm and ride a bike sharing bike. So we know that there are parts of the country that where you're not going to see this happen. If you look at San Francisco, and I think San Francisco is one of the most enthusiastic places about all these alternate means of transportation. You can take a subway train system. You can get car sharing programs. They are about to get a bike sharing program that will stretch from San Francisco down to San Jose, over to Oakland. And so they think of it as a regional situation. As far as the suburbs go, you know, there are a lot of college towns now that have ride sharing programs and have bike sharing programs. And I think what you're seeing is sort of big cities first, and then the fill-in comes from the college towns, and then some of the other suburbs say, we'd like to have that as well.
Well, what would you be looking for as the implications of us driving less? And we should mention, by the way, that more than 80% of people still go to work in a private vehicle.
That's right. First of all, if you're going to buy a car and you're not going to use it very much, you'll probably try to get the most car or the car that will meet your needs the most rather than something huge that would protect you on a 40-mile commute. That would lead you to think that maybe smaller cars or the small SUVs will become more popular. And then second, another issue in all of this is how much it costs to drive, because you have insurance costs, car payments, the cost of gasoline, which is bounced around $4 a gallon. People are looking at that as well. So for the car companies, it means you may have a chance once a decade to try to sell a family a car. You have to make your very best case to that family to make this investment, because the kids can get on their skateboards, the bus comes down the street, and you know that's an argument against owning an individual automobile.
Mickey, the website Jalopnik recently posed the question, have we hit peak car ownership? And they concluded, we're all doomed if that is the case. So you've covered the industry for a long time. Do you think that we're looking at the beginning of the end of the car?
I think it's, as Winston Churchill would say, it's probably the end of the beginning. So let me explain what I mean by that. The automobile has been around for about 100, 115 years. And for us in America, that stretched from about 1910, 1915 onward. In other countries, auto ownership is much more recent than it is for us. In Europe, cars were luxury vehicles. India, Japan, China, all those countries in Asia didn't really develop an automotive ownership habit until the last couple of decades. So with this habit has also come the time when people are interested in the environment. And so some governments are actually talking about limiting car sales. If you look at London, London has the congestion tax during the middle of the day. They don't want people driving into London. So when you talk about peak car, it doesn't mean that we suddenly see car sales plummet around the world. It just means that we're not going to be on that growth path that everybody expected.
Isn't there something fundamentally American, though, about being able to drive around at will whenever you want to do it? I'm thinking of a trip I took in a car from Los Angeles to New York, and it was such a beautiful experience and so incredible to drive across the United States.
It is a terrific experience. The automobile is a fundamental part of our freedom and our mobility. But people who are looking at cars today, especially younger people, they don't necessarily see that. It used to be that you had to borrow the keys from your parents to get in the car and get away from them. Now all you have to do is sit in the back seat, put your headphones on, and get on your mobile device, and you've escaped from your parents. So escape for our parents and grandparents is different than escape for 20, 25-year-olds today.
Mickey Maynard, contributor to Forbes.com, the editor of the upcoming ebook Curbing Cars, Rethinking How We Get Around. Mickey, thanks so much.
Thank you, Jeremy.
So, how are cities responding to fewer cars? What would happen if parking spaces weren't required when new buildings went up? We'll talk with an urban planner about that in a moment.
Funding for Here and Now comes from GEICO, offering a variety of insurance products, including auto, renters, boat, and motorcycle. More at geico.com or 1-800-947-AUTO.
It's Here and Now. We've been talking about new research showing that Americans are driving less, and we want to look now at what that means for cities. Michael Manville is a professor of urban planning at Cornell University. And Michael, start by telling us how much today's cities are built around the automobile.
Almost every city's zoning code, one way or the other, is designed in the United States in 2013 to accommodate vehicle use. The good examples of that are many city transportation departments are much more likely to widen a street than to narrow one. And, of course, the ultimate example is that in almost every city in the country, when you go to develop commercial property, the city planning department forces you to build parking spaces with that. And that is a sort of a direct way to accommodate vehicle use.
I remember walking down Park Avenue in New York City, which these days has several lanes of traffic on both sides and then a park in the middle, and then seeing an image of Park Avenue many decades ago when it was just maybe one or two lanes of traffic on each side and the whole middle was a park. So what a change in the last several decades.
Absolutely. I think that a lot of the story of transportation planning from almost 1950 onwards has been to sort of remake cities in the image of the automobile. There was a fear that if cities weren't more friendly to cars, they would lose population to the suburbs. It has resulted in very dramatic changes in the built environment of even old cities.
And yet, these days, it seems the trend is moving in the other direction. Cities have decided that they would rather have more green space, fewer cars on the roads right through the middle of the city. It's evidenced right here in Boston, where the Big Dig has created a huge park right in the downtown area.
Absolutely. A lot of cities have decided that their land is simply too valuable to hand over to drivers at almost no cost. And the Big Dig's a great example, and so are these examples where a number of cities have decided to roll back some of these parking mandates.
So tell us about that, the parking mandates. How widespread are those, and what would be the implications if the cities did not require the same amount of parking in a new building that's being built, for example?
Every zoning code in the country has, for at least some parts of the city, and usually for all of the city, these requirements that basically say if you are going to build housing, there's a ratio of parking spaces per unit that you have to provide on that site. And what these do from the transportation side is they move what should be a cost of driving, right? The cost of storing your car. They take that away from the driver and they put it in the property market. And the result of that is that driving becomes sort of artificially inexpensive. And if the cost of storing that vehicle is actually paid in the cost of rent rather than in your decision to drive, you're going to drive a little bit more than you otherwise would.
Well, what has happened in cities that have rolled back their parking requirements?
One thing that happens is you get more housing, you get more development, because the parking requirement places a very large burden on people who want to develop property. If you have to go underground, build subterranean parking, each space can easily cost you $50,000.
Wow.
And faced with that requirement, you're not going to build housing that's marketed toward lower-income people. Hmm. You're not going to build housing that's marketed toward anyone who doesn't drive.
So, in fact, getting rid of parking requirements, you're saying, would help low-income people? You would never even think about that.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, if you think of the people in the United States who don't own cars, who do the least driving, they tend to be people of low income. And if you have zoning codes that force developers to provide housing that comes with parking spaces, what you are implicitly saying is that it is illegal to build housing explicitly for people who are too poor to own cars.
Hmm. There are going to be a lot of people out there who hear us talking about getting rid of parking spaces, and they say, well, what about all the cars that we have? This is going to cause a huge crowding problem.
Okay. When you say you want to remove minimum parking requirements, all you're saying is that the government no longer is able to tell a property owner exactly where and how many parking spaces they build.
But the net effect is going to be there are fewer parking spaces.
In many instances, it will be. But because you're not prohibiting parking, if you run into a time where, oh my God, there's not enough parking spaces, someone's going to build them because they'll be worth a lot of money. If you look at almost any city in the country, almost all of them have unused parking spaces. And in places that have removed parking requirements or deregulated parking, what we just see pop up is a more creative market in parking, where a developer might build an apartment building and not provide too many spaces on site, but, you know, leases a few unused spaces down the street from the bank or the newspaper building that has them empty in the evening. Hmm. You know, there's all sorts of ways to meet the need for parking without forcing people to build it on site.
What about the alternatives, what people would have to turn to if they didn't drive as much as they do now? And one of the big movements right now is bikes and bike sharing. How do you set up cities so that that is accessible to as many people as possible?
The kind of policies that are really going to help encourage cycling and walking are going to go beyond just is everything sort of nearby, but also when you're walking, when you're cycling, do you feel safe? You know, bike lanes accomplish that, and so too do something as simple as having diagonal parking on streets can make pedestrians feel a lot more comfortable. It just puts them further away from the traffic.
You love what's going on in Copenhagen. Tell us what you think they're doing right.
Denmark has a type of street that's called a Wunerf. It's a street with almost no signage and no demarcated zones per vehicle. So basically, on these streets, which are fairly narrow, drivers mix with cyclists, mix with people pushing strollers. You know, there's no traffic signals.
There's chaos.
And what it sounds like it would be. But when you examine it, it ends up working pretty well because everyone basically in that situation has to take some responsibility for not only themselves, but their interaction with everyone else on the road. And so what basically happens is that everybody slows down.
I've heard that used as an example when people are talking about roundabouts versus stoplights, is that when you have to go through a roundabout or a rotary, you actually have to think. Whereas if you trust the stoplight, you're not really using your brain when you're going through it. You're just saying, oh, it's green, that means go. And that's where a lot of accidents happen.
Absolutely. You know, every day in this country somewhere, an accident happens because a pedestrian has mindlessly looked at the little walk light and a driver has mindlessly looked at the green light and then has turned right into the pedestrian because neither looks at each other.
Hmm.
It's a way of forcing people to take into account their context and be aware of everybody else around them.
So big picture, Michael Manville, are we moving toward a society that is less focused on cars? And are we ready? Are cities ready for what that means for them?
I think that cities should be organized in a way that encourages people to drive less. And we should do that for environmental reasons. We should do that simply for efficiency reasons, because a lot of our cities are terribly congested. So I think that it's up to cities to take the lead and have these policies that say, you know, we're going to make it so that we no longer sort of subsidize driving, but rather we're going to encourage other modes of travel and, you know, make driving easy, because driving is great, but also make it sort of pay its full way.
Michael Manville is an urban planner with the Department of City and Regional Planning at Cornell. Michael, thank you so much for joining us.
No, thank you.
Well, what do you think? Should we have fewer parking spaces in cities? What is your city doing? Go to hereandnow.org and let us know. The latest news is next.
Funding for Here and Now comes from Eton, offering the American Red Cross Radio Line a portable solar-powered radio with cell phone charger and flashlight for emergencies or travel, now at Best Buy. And the Cancer Center at Beth Israel Deaconess, where researchers are working to discover new ways of diagnosing and treating a variety of cancers. BIDMC.org/cancercenter.